troops from Syria. He was supposed to stay in his position through the end of February to kind of help ensure a smooth transition. But yesterday, Trump announced via Twitter that Patrick Shanahan, Mattis's deputy, will become the acting defense secretary as of January 1st. And at the same time, you have Brett McGurk, who was the U.S. envoy for the global coalition to defeat ISIS, also reportedly resigning over Trump's Syria decision.
Okay, so we have acting defense secretary. We also have an acting attorney general. We also have an acting White House chief of staff. We also have an acting interior secretary. What does this mean looking into 2019? Like, is it just going to be a calendar full of confirmation battles?
It will be a calendar full of confirmation battles. It's not clear how hard it will be to get people in place because Republicans did gain 2 seats in the Senate in midterms, but it's going to take a lot of time, a lot of resources and attention focused on just kind of getting officials into position. And that's time where big parts of the administration will be without permanent leadership and kind of in limbo.
And one other cabinet secretary to bring up, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, released this sort of unexpected statement about conversations he's been having with the heads of all the big banks in the United States. What, is that normal? What is this?
Well, so he released a statement that he talked to executives and confirmed that they have plenty of liquidity to continue lending to consumers. The issue with that is that people hadn't really been questioning whether there was liquidity.
He was answering a question that wasn't being asked.
Yes. But what people had been concerned about was this idea. There were reports that President Trump was maybe thinking of trying to get rid of or trying to demote Fed Chairman Jerome Powell. And that had been stirring concern. So Mnuchin released this tweet to kind of try to tamp down those concerns. But he didn't mention Powell, which kind of just raised more questions than answers.
NPR's Aisha Roscoe. Aisha, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, so the government may be partially shut down, but as we head into Christmas, there is one holiday-related government service that's still going, NORAD's Santa Tracker.
Santa knows the skies above North America are safe as can be because one command is watching.
That's right. The command is a decades-long tradition. The North American Aerospace Defense Command tracks Santa's journey on Christmas Eve into the early hours of Christmas morning, keeping real-time tabs on his trip from the North Pole and across the globe delivering toys.
Around 1,500 volunteers support military personnel in order to pull this off every year. And it's not just tracking Santa's journey.
Well, he'll be there around 11:30 tonight.
They field calls and emails from curious kids who have questions about Santa, like, what's his birthday?
I love this. And actually, the NORAD Track Santa tradition dates back 63 years. This is dating back to when a department store ad gave kids a number to call to reach Santa. But the ad had a misprint in the number, which sent a flood of calls to Colonel Harry Shoup at the Continental Air Defense Command Operations Center. His kids recounted the story on NPR in 2014.
They had children calling one after another, so he put a couple airmen on the phones to act like Santa Claus.
Today, volunteers answer more than 100,000 calls, and the NORAD Track Santa website gets millions of visitors.
And let's just get the recent update here. According to the tracker, as of early this morning, Santa was in his workshop, still preparing to take off.
All right, all this year we've been looking at the changing demographics of who is going to college in this country. Today, people from small towns and rural areas. Many of them are the first in their families to go to college, and some schools are recognizing that these students need help with the adjustment. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports from the University of Michigan.
They come from all over, from small towns in the Upper Peninsula in northern Michigan to southern Louisiana. But the descriptions of their hometowns sound really similar.
It's a very close-knit family community. Most people know each other.
Around it is just cornfields. We have like a drive your tractor to school day.
We used to have a McDonald's, but it closed, sadly.
It's really small. It's kind of like a stereotypical small town where, you know, everybody knows your grandparents and your grandparents' parents and all of that.
Many of them had the same initial reaction to stepping on a college campus.
There were a lot of people. There were so many people.
That's Alexandra Remiger. She introduces herself from near Charlotte, Michigan, a town of about 9,000. That's very different from this campus of about 46,000 undergrads.
Every day you would see a face you have never seen before, like many faces you have never seen before, and I just wasn't used to it.
For Kendra Bodewine, a sophomore from Lake Linden, Michigan, population 1,007, It was the little things that caught her off guard, like crosswalks.
Those don't exist where I lived.
Students here, she says, they don't even look twice. And when she broke her phone freshman year, she didn't get a new one for 3 months.
And I was carrying around this paper map everywhere I went, and people would give me like funny looks just because who carries a paper map anymore?
Needing directions felt emblematic of her experience and those of other rural students in and out of the classroom.
I wasn't comfortable with necessarily asking for help. It was almost like I felt bad for not knowing.
Programs that nudge rural students to ask for help are popping up all over the country. In Michigan, the university has started extending support that typically has been afforded to urban students. Kendra and Alex, they're both part of the Kessler Presidential Scholars Program here, a group of about 40 students that receive scholarship money and academic support on campus. About a third are from rural areas. It's a community within a community, a place where you can admit you know nothing about college.
I had no idea, like, what financial aid meant. I thought undergrad was the first 2 years and, like, graduate school was junior and senior year, so I really, like, just didn't know anything.
In high schools, rural students actually graduate at higher rates than urban students and about the same levels as suburban students, but they're less likely to go on to college, and once they get there, they're also more likely to drop out. Students in Kessler are assigned upperclassmen mentors, and once a week, they attend a group lecture. On one Wednesday evening, the talk is by linguistics professor Ann Curzan.
How do we embrace linguistic diversity instead of what we do right now, which is often tell people that they talk wrong?
If you have an accent or speak another language at home, or if you have a different vocabulary than your classmates, that's okay, she says.
Part of our cultures and part of our identities, part of who we are, is our language.
Other lectures touch on research opportunities or explain why it's important to go to office hours.
I'm still intimidated by professors. Like, going to their office hours is terrifying.
For Kendra, practicing what to say and talking about all this stuff with other Kessler students is giving her a little extra confidence because she's constantly reminded that some kids on campus, they're really good with this stuff.
It's almost like a sense of entitlement. Like, some students, you know, they're comfortable, they're relaxed, they're okay with talking back to the teachers and or, like, arguing a grade.
To her, arguing with a professor, not even an option. Kendra grew up with a single mom and helped to raise her four younger siblings. Everyone knew her back home. Her grandfather lived right next door.
There was definitely moments where I was like, I'm only going here to fill like a diversity quota and I don't really belong here and everybody else is so much smarter than me.
One major aim of the support program at Michigan, make rural students feel like they belong. And that can be hard with so many misconceptions of who rural students are.
I was told once while being here that I was raised wrong because of where I'm from.
That's Cameron Russell, a freshman from Crowley, Louisiana, a small town known as the rice capital of America. He says he's constantly trying to re-educate people about the South.
People expect me to be like this extreme bigot.
Or just not very smart.
As they call it, a yeehaw.
It makes him sad, but it doesn't make him any less proud. For Cameron, being a rural student is a complicated identity. His hometown is part of him. He sorely misses his grandmother's gumbo. But it's also a place he's leaving behind. Before he headed to college last summer, he sat his mom down for a talk.
Mom, I think this was my last year in Crowley. And that made me cry thinking about it because I love where I'm from and I'm gonna miss my family.
But Cameron knows if he wants to finish his degree and have a career in biochemistry, he's not going back to Crowley, Louisiana. Alyssa Nadworthy, NPR News, Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Alyssa's story was produced in partnership with the Hechinger Report. That's a nonprofit independent news organization. This is NPR News.
Morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and bless the reporter's heart that Charlotte, Michigan, that she mentioned is actually, for reasons that no one knows, Charlotte, Michigan. Well, coming up on Morning Edition, President Trump decided it's time to pull U.S. ground troops out of the fight against ISIS in Syria, and the announcement surprised a lot of people, including his military advisors. How do people in Syria feel? We'll hear more about that in 15 minutes here on WPR.
Meetings of the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin System and its committees that relate to this broadcast station are generally open to the public. Certain meetings or portions of meetings may be closed in order to address confidential information or proprietary matters. More information about specific meeting dates, times, and locations is available on the WPR website at WPR.org. Support for WPR comes from WEA Member Benefits, dedicated to helping Wisconsin public school employees become financially secure with programs designed exclusively for the education community. WEABenefits.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, mugs, books, and more. Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911.
Today, partly to mostly sunny, chance of light snow or a wintry mix in the late evening, and highs in the upper 20s to low 30s. For tomorrow, mostly cloudy with some light snow showers possible in the southern half of the state, highs in the 30s. And cloudy during the day on Wednesday, but a wintry mix and maybe some snow possible late in the day, highs in the 30s.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Airtable, an all-in-one collaboration platform used by over 80,000 companies. Airtable is designed to help companies manage their work their way. Learn more at Airtable.com. From Tire Rack, with more than 500 tire models from 22 manufacturers, and an online tool for finding tires based on vehicle needs, budget, and brand. TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, install. And from ProQuest, whose history vault features 18 million pages of documents from times of social, cultural, and political change in America. At proquest.com/go/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green. When athletes take a shot to the head, it is hard to know exactly what will happen to their brains. NPR's John Hamilton spent some time with a scientist who is trying to understand why certain head impacts are worse than others.
Philip Bailey's interest in brain injuries began with a question about soccer players. Bailey's a mechanical engineer at Washington University in St. Louis, and in the 2000s, he met with some doctors who treat injured athletes.
They said, well, we've got some kids who have concussions, and they want to know if they can go back to play, and we don't know what's happening to their head when they're heading a soccer ball.
Was it a big impact or a small one? The doctors thought Bailey might have the answer.
I said, that's really interesting. I play soccer, and my kids play soccer, and I don't know what's happening when you hit a soccer ball either, but I know how we can find out.
Bailey brought some soccer players into the lab to find out how much acceleration their heads experienced. The answer? 15 to 20 times the force of gravity. Bailey says that's a moderate impact.
Jump up and down, you're maybe feeling 4 or 5 G's when you hit the ground. When you play football, you have a hard collision with someone else, it's maybe 50 to 100 G's.
But Bailey realized these numbers didn't mean much unless he knew how much of this force was reaching a person's brain. So he spent more than a decade trying to figure that out. It's an effort that has involved jiggling a lot of living human brains. Charlotte Gertler, a graduate student in Bailey's lab, shows one way to do that.
So your head is resting on this. So now if I turn it on, it'll make it vibrate again. Can you feel it vibrating? Yeah, that's what vibrates the back of your head, and that's how we see the waves inside your head.
A special type of MRI shows how moving a person's head causes their brain to deform slightly. And Bailey says the research has revealed something about head impacts he didn't expect.
And so what we saw, surprisingly, was that the brain wasn't, you know, colliding and bouncing against the walls of the skull, but it was pulling away from points of attachment.
These points of attachment anchor the brain to the skull, and Bailey says they usually act like the shock absorbers on a car.
Your brain is much better protected and suspended than it would be if it was just, you know, rattling around inside your skull. But like any suspension system, it can fail.
Especially with certain types of impacts. One is a blow that causes a person's head to rotate. Another is an impact to the back of the head. This can actually tear the attachment points at the front of the brain and cause dangerous bleeding. Bailey says the brain suspension system probably works pretty well when someone heads a soccer ball. What's still not clear, he says, is whether that's enough to prevent damage when players head the ball over and over again, as they often do in practice.
So understanding the mechanical behavior of the brain at relatively low accelerations is more important than we ever thought.
John Hamilton, NPR News.
If you're still scrambling this Christmas Eve to find a last-minute present, you may want to consider a gratitude journal. A growing body of research shows that logging your thanks can boost your mental and maybe even your physical health. Manvi Singh has the story.
Over this past year, Eileen Sue has kept a monthly list.
February 2018. I'm grateful that my family is so understanding. I'm grateful that so many people care.
Sometimes it's big stuff. And sometimes it's the little blessings.
July, I'm grateful for good hair after I shower.
Sue started gratitude journaling when she was in college and feeling really low. She's now 28 and a lifestyle blogger. And she's recommended the practice to nearly 750,000 YouTube subscribers. It wasn't a hard sell. Psychologist Lori Santos teaches a class on happiness at Yale.
I think there, just over the last few years, there's been more of a trend to focus on gratitude.
In wellness blogs and magazines, gratitude apps and journals.
Those types of products can remind us to take time to be grateful. But it's also important to remember that gratitude is free.
And it pays off. A growing body of research shows that counting blessings can help you sleep better. It can lower stress and improve your relationships with others. There's also some evidence it could lower your risk of heart disease. And it may help lower depression in some people.
And the research suggests that taking time to focus on those positives, in addition to the negatives, can boost our mood more than we expect.
Listing out what you're grateful for is one way of doing it. You could thank God or the universe or other people. You could keep it all private, or you could share it. Psychologist Sonia Lubomirsky studies gratitude at the University of California, Riverside. Her advice?
Really think about what feels right, what feels natural or enjoyable or meaningful to you.
And try to do it regularly, but not too often. In one study, Lubomirsky found that counting blessings once a week boosted happiness. But doing so three times a week did not. She warns that too much gratitude can backfire.
Because sometimes when you express gratitude, you could also feel humbled or indebted or maybe even embarrassed. So it doesn't always actually feel pleasant.
And it's not a panacea. Psychologist Santos says sometimes gratitude research can feel Pollyanna-ish.
You know, when we talk about, you know, focus on the things you're grateful for, we think that's equivalent to, you know, like ignoring all the bad things in the world.
Gratitude cannot make injustice, loss, or pain disappear. What it can do is give us hope. In Oakland, California, 31-year-old mental health counselor Seda Garcia agrees. When she first started making gratitude lists 5 years ago, it felt a bit hokey.
Yeah, it felt kind of like fake a little bit.
During really tough times, like when she'd lost a job and she was sleeping on her friend's mom's couch, she felt like she was reaching for reasons to be grateful. But she still tried to find some.
Even if it's literally like, I'm grateful for the sun that's shining today or being able to wake up.
Over the years, she says it's helped her change her perspective. And this little shift has made all the difference. For NPR News, I'm Manvi Singh, and I'm very thankful to you for listening.
Thank you for listening to us on your local member station. You can keep the conversation going with us on social media. I'm Noelle King. You can reach me on Twitter at Noelle King. Rachel Martin is at Rachel NPR. David Green is at NPR Green. And Stephen Skeep is at NPR InSkeep. To find out more about the people who put this show together every day, go to our website, npr.org/morningedition, and click on the staff tabs to read about our amazing crew of editors and producers. This is NPR News.
It has been 50 years since the Apollo 8 shot astronauts out of the Earth's orbit for the first time. One of them was Jim Lovell.
The biggest gift that we gave was to the American public to be eventually proud to be an American.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, talking to astronaut Jim Lovell about a historic Christmas Eve broadcast from space. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and a news update from NPR is next. In the WPR newscast, we'll hear about what the U.S. Public Interest Research Group has to say about toys that spy in its yearly report.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. It's unclear when the partial shutdown of the federal government might end. Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney says a counteroffer was presented over the weekend to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. Mulvaney says the president is willing to accept less than his original demand of $5 billion for a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border as part of a government spending plan. Here's NPR's Tamara Keith.
The White House is willing to come down, and Democrats are willing to come up on the dollar amount. The problem, though, is what that money gets spent on, because Democrats are holding firm and saying no wall, no fence, whatever you want to call it, no physical barrier. They want to spend it on technology or personnel or other things to secure the border.
The Senate reconvenes on Thursday. A former prime minister of Pakistan is facing 7 years in prison for corruption. NPR's Dia Hadid says it's the latest prison sentence for Nawaz Sharif.
The court said Nawaz Sharif couldn't prove how he came to own a steel mill in Saudi Arabia. Sharif was Pakistan's prime minister until the courts barred him from public office last year. He's also appealing another case that had sentenced him to 10 years in prison. His supporters allege that Sharif is being unfairly persecuted.
In Afghanistan today, injuries but no deaths are reported after a car bomb went off outside a government building in Kabul. This is NPR News.
This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. 8:31 now. I'm Melissa Ingalls. A consumer group is warning parents about toys that can spy on their kids. In its annual Trouble in Toyland report, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group says such items could pose problems. Emily Fisher is with Whisper.
So parents should think carefully about buying smart toys for their kids. We recommend evaluating what a smart toy knows about your child, who it might share this information with, and for what purpose, and what security risks that could pose.
In 2017, the FBI issued a warning to parents about toys connected to the internet, noting they typically contain microphones and cameras. Some toys also include speech recognition and GPS. Madison Water Utility officials say they will step up testing for toxic chemicals that are spreading from contaminated soil and groundwater at Truax Air National Guard Base on the city's north side. The State Journal reports that fluorinated compounds from military firefighting foam have soaked into soil and shallow groundwater on the base. Last year, the chemicals turned up in low levels at a city well nearly a mile away. The Air National Guard has known about the contamination for at least 3 years, but hasn't monitored its spread, so authorities aren't sure if levels in the well water will rise to more dangerous numbers. Fluorinated compounds have been linked to serious health problems. Madison Water Utility spokeswoman Amy Barilow says the collection of monthly samples will begin in January. A Minnesota-based poultry producer is recalling more than 164,000 pounds of raw ground turkey products that may be contaminated with salmonella. The Jennie-O Turkey Store products have markings saying to use or freeze by November 12th or 13th. The recall includes plain ground turkey and turkey with taco or Italian seasonings. The products were shipped to a number of states, including Wisconsin, Illinois, and Minnesota. Food safety officials are worried that some contaminated turkey may be in people's freezers. The recalled products have the tag P579 marked on the lower left corner of the front of the package. The USDA says the recall was part of an investigation into a November salmonella outbreak that involved 216 patients in 38 states. Partly to mostly sunny today, a chance of light snow or a wintry mix in the late evening. We'll have highs in the upper 20s to the low 30s. It's 8:34.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Tire Rack, with more than 500 tire models from 22 manufacturers and an online tool for finding tires based on vehicle needs, budget, and brand. TireRack.com, helping drivers find, deliver, install. And from Atlassian, a collaboration software company powering teams around the world, committed to providing the tools and practices to help teams plan, track, build, and work better together. More at Atlassian.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noel King. Good morning. Last week, President Trump announced his decision to withdraw U.S. ground troops from Syria. He said ISIS has been defeated. NPR's Ruth Sherlock is in northeastern Syria, where U.S. troops have been operating. She's been talking to people on the ground who will be directly affected by this decision. Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
So you arrived there just as word hit about President Trump's decision to withdraw about 2,200 troops. What have people been telling you in these towns that you're visiting?
There's a deep sense of betrayal here. So we've been driving around these towns, and in these places you can clearly see the US military bases that are dotted across this landscape. They're these sprawling complexes with mud bank defenses and watchtowers. In one town near a base, we met Haji Haider. He's a blacksmith by trade. This area used to be controlled by ISIS, and he's lived through all of the offensive to push them out. It was these local Kurdish troops working with the U.S. military that pushed ISIS out. And people here feel angry that the U.S. is leaving now.
Because all this job, all the work that they did together, and now they are leaving in this quickly, he don't understand it. And people are afraid. He said that it seems like people, they sell this country.
So the U.S. allies here, this Kurdish militia, basically formed the ground force that fought ISIS. And they lost thousands of men and women on these front lines. In another town, we met a man who said he lost 7 people, all of them young, in their 20s, fighting ISIS.
So is it fair to say that the Kurds, our allies, are very upset about this decision?
Yeah, they're really trying to get a handle on the news. We've spoken to senior Kurdish military officials and spokesmen, and they say that they first learned of the troop withdrawal on television, in the news. So they're angry, but they're also saying that there are serious implications to this. Kino Gabriel is a spokesman for the US-backed militia, the SDF, and he's worried that this decision will actually allow ISIS to expand again.
I think a lot of people give their lives in this fight, and I think it would be a big loss to throw everything they have sacrificed for. Everything, I think, is going to be to go in vain if we allowed ISIS to reemerge.
He believes that the US withdrawing essentially leaves the Kurdish authorities who control this part of Syria exposed to new threats, and they're going to have to redirect troops against those instead of fighting the remaining pockets of ISIS.
Let's talk about the new threats to the Kurds, because Turkey is threatening to attack the Kurds there. What are Kurds telling you about that?
Yeah, well, this is their main concern, even more so than ISIS. Turkey sees the Kurds in this area as being aligned with terrorists, and they've been moving troops to the border. So the Kurds are trying to look at options for stopping this offensive.
Do the Kurds have any options or backup plans to make up for the loss of U.S. support? Anyone else they can call on?
They said that all options are on the table. At the moment, they're trying to reach out to all sides. They've been talking to the Western allies, France in particular, and they're also on the other side of the civil war in Syria, reaching out to the Syrian regime. You know, this is an oil-rich part of the country, and the regime wants to take back control. The Kurds say they might be open to striking some kind of deal, and one Kurdish military official we spoke to said they would even be willing to coordinate with Syrian troops in an offensive against Turkey should Turkey try to invade.
NPR's Ruth Sherlock in northeastern Syria. Ruth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I don't know about you. I hit a point just a few days ago when I felt like, okay, I'm ready to hear the holiday music in taxis, coffee shops, on the radio, television. Just bring it. Early December, Thanksgiving, to me, that is just too early. But that's not the case for people in the Philippines. NPR's Julie McCarthy says people there start feeling the holiday cheer before Christmas, like 4 months before. Here's her postcard from Manila.
There's no chance of snow, but there is passion in this tropical archipelago for Christmas that is unparalleled. From the glories of the Philippine Philharmonic Orchestra, its Ode to Joy, sung by the celebrated University of Santo Tomas singers at the iconic Peninsula Hotel's annual Christmas concert. Church choruses, such as the Mary the Queen Parish Choir, enliven the mood. Christmas-obsessed Filipinos launch their Yuletide season in the so-called Burr months. September, October, November. Their Christmas season is as visually resplendent as it is long. Hotel lobbies glisten with decorations worthy of a czar's winter palace. Christmas parades feature full-blown floats. The Philippines stands out in Asia for being more than 90% Christian, mostly Catholic. But is the true meaning of the season getting lost with all the Christmas fever? Wilfrido Arcilia, a marketing consultant and professor at Manila's Ateneo Graduate School of Business, says no. Rather, he says, this season reflects the many facets that define Filipino culture.
Family and faith, fiesta and food, friends and fun.
Arcilia says a healthy balance still exists between the secular and spiritual at Christmas time. Father Flavio Villanueva says the church should not antagonize people by attacking the commercialism of Christmas, but rather draw them closer to the teachings of the faith.
So that they might be liberated from that enslaving thought that Christmas is mainly about buying gifts. It's more of looking at Santa Claus rather than the child Jesus.
The church is arguably holding its own when millions attend Misa de Gallo or Rooster Mass. In a tradition dating to the Spanish colonial era, Catholics go to 9 consecutive masses ending on Christmas Eve Day. Services start at 5 in the morning. A test of faith for worshipers like choir director Carolyn Chang.
It helps build anticipation for the feast. Some people go straight from parties to the mass.
After nourishing the soul, it's time to eat. And tonight, many will tuck into the cherished Christmas feast of roasted pig, whole ones known as lechon. Lechonero Ariel de los Reyes says business has been brisk at his 60-year-old establishment. I ask De los Reyes if his family eats lechon for Christmas.
No. We eat hot dogs and ham. That's it. And hot chocolate.
On Christmas Day, this family of pig roasters wants a break from the food that their countrymen are savoring with friends and family. Being with family is the number one wish that Filipinos ask for this season. Maki Takagaki had a unique wish.
I want a boyfriend.
Well, it is all about love at Christmas. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Manila.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:42. I'm Melissa Ingalls, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. In the new movie Destroyer, actress Nicole Kidman plays an LAPD detective who's complicated, angry, and damaged.
She's tough, and she's capable of fighting, and she's capable of using weapons, and she's got demons as well.
In about 9 minutes, we'll hear more from Kidman on playing the sort of gritty cop role that's usually reserved for men.
I love everything about BBC NewsHour. I love that it takes us to stories that American news organizations don't always cover. I love the international perspectives that the BBC NewsHour gives us. It's a way for us to see what's happening in other parts of the world, but it's also a way we might see what may be coming to our part of the world at the same time.
Get perspective on your world with international news coverage on the BBC NewsHour with Brady Carlson, weekdays at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Capital Lakes, a continuing care retirement community offering all levels of care. Located in Madison, close to Overture Center, Monona Terrace, and the UW campus. More is at retirement.org.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a one-stop shop for the holidays. Eat at Jack's Cafe and then peruse their collection of holiday decor. Unique gifts for everyone on your list and have them gift-wrapped for free. 2401 60th Street, Kenosha.
44 now, and here are some of the top stories we're following today. Thousands of soldiers, police, and government personnel, as well as volunteers, are working to find victims of an Indonesian tsunami. At least 373 people have died and more than 1,400 are injured when the waves washed ashore Saturday night. The number of casualties may still rise. U.S. officials say they're not sure if Deputy Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan will be President Donald Trump's nominee to replace Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, who is leaving the department sooner than expected. But Trump tweets that Shanahan will take over as acting secretary on January 1st. You can always get more news from NPR and WPR on our website. Go to WPR.org. Here's what the weather looks like for today. Partly to mostly sunny, a chance of light snow or a wintry mix in the late evening, highs in the upper 20s to low 30s. Cloudy tomorrow with some light snow and highs in the 30s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features, presenting Mary, Queen of Scots. A rebellious young queen stops at nothing to reclaim her throne. Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie star as warring queens, now playing in theaters everywhere. And from Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Office locations are at visitingangels.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King. Good morning. The new book, Coloring Without Borders, is not a typical coloring book. Yes, there are pictures of two bears looking for breakfast and some birds looking for friends and a fantasy city and a treehouse, but the captions are in both English and Spanish, and there are no lines to color in. Instead, the drawings are left unfinished so kids can fill them in. Jennifer Sofia Hall curated the book. She wanted to help immigrant families separated at the U.S.-Mexico border, and the proceeds from the book go to Families Belong Together. Hall convinced more than 80 artists to take part, including the illustrator and author Christian Robinson.
I was feeling troubled by the headlines and the images that I was seeing of families being separated and children being detained. And I was feeling like our country could be doing better, but I wasn't really sure of what I could be doing. And when Jennifer emailed me, I saw her invitation to be a part of Coloring Without Borders as a way for me to get involved and help.
My guess would be that as an artist, you've thought a lot about how art and politics intersect. And I wonder, you know, given the times we're living in, do you think that artists have a responsibility to respond to political events that disturb them, like the separation of migrant children from their families at the border?
I don't know if artists have a responsibility, but I know for me personally that it's important to reflect the times that we live in, to put a mirror to it. And it's almost like I couldn't create without, taking into account all the things that are happening around me.
Describe your drawing in the book and tell me, what were you trying to communicate with it?
So my illustration for the book is basically a bird flying out of a cage that's been opened. And the caption is, "Draw all the birds flying out of the cage." And it's in English and in Spanish. I just wanted to create an image where kids could just draw all these birds just flying and being free from the thing that was holding them.
I know that part of the idea behind this book is that it will help kids and their parents talk, right, about some of the serious issues that we face in society today. If someone says to you skeptically, you know, this is a coloring book, what do you say?
Actually, what sold me on this project was the fact that these books were actually going to get into the hands of children who are being detained. I personally know firsthand the power of creativity and being able to express yourself, especially in circumstances where you might feel powerless. As a child, I grew up, and my mother, she struggled with drug addiction and was in and out of prison for most of my childhood. Drawing and creating was a way for me to escape, but it was also a way for me to have some control over my circumstances. I couldn't control the world around me, but I could at least control what the world looked like on a piece of paper. That's sort of the positive impact I think this book can have on the lives of these children and children all over the country on both sides of the border.
Christian Robinson is a contributing artist to the book Coloring Without Borders. Christian, thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, 10 minutes before 9 now. Coming up at 9, it's Lessons and Carols from King's College, Cambridge.
Support for WGTD comes from Classic Violins, the premier southeastern Wisconsin workshop for violin family instruments. Master Luthier, always on premises. ClassicViolins.com, 262-577-5488.
News updates and in-depth reporting. We help you see what's going on and really understand all of it. Start your day fully awake with Morning Edition. Listen every day.
We have some great holiday specials coming up over the next few days here on WPR. At noon today, Christmas at Luther College, featuring six choirs, orchestra, bell choir, and organ, celebrating the college's 39th annual holiday concert. At 1, the choirs of Morehouse and Spelman Colleges get together to present a program of spirituals and carols. And at 2, Laurie Skelton hosts an hour of carols from the Eau Claire Master Singers annual Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols. You can learn more about all of our holiday specials at WPR.org/holidays. In sports, the Packers beat the New York Jets yesterday, 44-38. And we're expecting partly to mostly sunny skies today with some light snow or maybe a wintry mix in the late evening. Highs in the upper 20s to the low 30s.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm David Green. Nicole Kidman has been pretty busy. She is currently starring in 3 movies as the Queen of Atlantis in Aquaman, as a supportive mother in the drama Boy Erased, and as a broken-down LAPD detective in Destroyer. That last one, a dark thriller, comes out tomorrow, and let's just say it's a counterpoint to Christmas cheer.
I'm taking these with me.
What? Hey!
Yeah, you want him back? Call me with names.
Don't do it, fool.
Call me with names.
NPR's Mandalito Barco interviewed Kidman and her director, Karin Kusama, about the making of Destroyer.
In Destroyer, Nicole Kidman looks like a hot mess. Puffy red eyes, dull, disheveled hair, no makeup, weather-beaten. In the opening scene, her character, LAPD Detective Aaron Bell, lumbers out of the car she slept in all night. She hobbles like a wounded animal to a crime scene along the concrete bank of the LA River.
Who is it?
No ID, no idea.
The raspy-voiced cop in a black leather jacket peers at a corpse with tattoos.
What about if I know who did this?
The film flashes back to when she was undercover with a gang planning a heist, and now she hunts an old nemesis. Here's Kidman's take on her character.
I mean, Aaron is complicated and damaged. Angry, shameful. When you meet her, she's on the road to trying to atone for a lot of the bad choices she's made and the things she's done that have caused damage to others.
Her character is in every scene of the film. She alternates between trying to counsel her wayward daughter.
I need to be able to find you.
Why?
Because I just do.
To brutally fistfighting her foes.
She's tough, and she's capable of fighting, and she's capable of using weapons, and she's got demons as well.
Kidman says director Karin Kusama had her prepare for the role by watching footage of wild coyotes.
These female coyotes with their young'uns, and they're around in Silver Lake, around the reservoir, and they were shot by drones, and she had this footage, and I watched that, and that actually really penetrated my performance. Strangely enough.
This is definitely the anti-Mary Poppins, but it's a very well-made thriller.
Claudia Puig is president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association.
Very unusual for a woman to play this sort of hard-bitten, often amoral detective that we see a lot of men play. It's a pretty twisted and dark movie to go see on Christmas Day, but maybe the day after.
I just want to talk.
I don't know why you're...
Stop!
You don't need to do this.
Detective Aaron Bell chases down informants and travels through parts of Los Angeles rarely seen on film. In fact, the same location manager from La La Land scouted sites for Destroyer, Skid Row, a colossal self-storage facility between freeways, an old Chinese diner in the gritty MacArthur Park area. As we drive around revisiting locations, director Karin Kusama gives her vision of L.A.
Chaos, beauty, ugliness, awe-inspiring, transcendental grace. What makes Los Angeles so interesting is it's not just, frankly, a beautiful city. In fact, there are many parts of it that are quite hard to look at. And then you can find yourself in some sort of pocket of paradise.
Kusama takes me and my editor Nina Gregory to a hidden patch of land where she shot a chase scene at night. We climb a rickety wooden staircase to get to a ridge in Elysian Park.
So from here you can see the Hollywood sign.
Yeah, we're pretty high actually right now in the city.
Is that gunshots or fireworks?
LAPD training.
That's where they shoot.
Yeah, right.
Fitting.
Yes, it is.
With the sounds of the Police Academy firing range and a freight train in the distance, we walk through the forested area on an uneven concrete trail past graffiti-carved pine trees.
There's prescription pill bottles and needles and old broken-down baby carriages. I mean, it's an intense spot, and at night it gets very intense.
We climb to the top of the hill to a grand vista.
And here's Dodger Stadium. Then you turn around, and there's downtown L.A.
Wow, this is amazing.
It is pretty great, right? And yet it's just abandoned. Here we are standing alone at the top of this perch in urban L.A.
Kusama's previous films include Girl Fight from 2000 about female boxers. She directed the supernatural horror comedy Jennifer's Body, and most recently a thriller called The Invitation. All have strong female characters. She calls Destroyer a sunlit noir.
Because so much of it is outside and it's just so blindingly bright, Aaron Bell proves to be both the detective and the femme fatale. In traditional noirs, women are tremendous troublemakers and very important agents in the story, but they're never the lead. And in this case, she gets to be both.
Kusama says Destroyer also harkens back to films from the 1970s, like Clue.
Why do I still want a trick?
And Taxi Driver.
You talking to me?
And Dog Day Afternoon.
He wants to kill me so bad he can taste it.
I got always going to kill
him. Attica! Attica! Attica!
Kusama says with flawed, morally ambiguous, alienated anti-heroes, those films reflected the political climate of the times. She sees Destroyer in that same vein.
It's much more about a feeling of despair, a sense of frustration with the larger culture, and a sense that most regular people are marginalized by the system. I feel a tremendous amount of that right now, every day, and this is my way of trying to grapple with it because I like watching a character make some terrible mistakes and make small steps toward being morally accountable, taking some personal responsibility for her own actions. And, you know, that's something I think we could all use seeing more examples of.
In a year where the biggest box office successes have starred superheroes and dinosaurs, Destroyer offers up a grim dose of reality for Christmas. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Noelle King.
Morning Edition is on the air every weekday from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. To follow developments throughout the day, visit WPR.org. There you can check out statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team, plus national and global headlines from NPR. It's a minute before 9. Stay with us. Lessons and Carols is next.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support for WGTD comes from Brage. The art gallery and Christmas gift shop is open 10 to 4 on Saturdays. Brage, serving organic teas, coffee, and espresso, homemade quiche, and baked goods at affordable prices. Brage Coffee Wine Music Art.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD,